This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello, welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I am Chinedu Opo. Here's what's coming up. This week, the president of the Democratic Republic of Congo said the state of siege in the country's east will remain in place indefinitely. President Felix Tshisekedi said in his speech to the United Nations General Assembly that the state of siege would remain until the reason for it is gone. His government imposed the state of siege in May in North Kivu and Ituri provinces, saying it was necessary to suppress violent militia groups in the east. Under the state of siege, military commanders from the armed forces of the DRC, or FARDC, have replaced the provincial governments. Many people in the region are unhappy with the president's decision. Journalist Jafar Akatani tells VOA Kate Pound-Dawson that many say the siege has made little progress in halting militant violence. He reports the army, however, is pointing to one recent success.
People and all parliament members from North Kivu and Ituri think that that is no sense, because no one believes that one day militia will end in DRC or in East. For example, I talked to one of member of parliament in North Kivu who said before state of siege equals to after state of siege. So if the president say that the state of siege will end the day militia will finish, that means they will never end. And today there was a protest in Goma done by people from the Beni region, because for them there is not a reason of the state of siege, because state of siege is not arranging anything for them.
In other words, people are saying the state of siege has not yet improved the situation.
Yes, because in the north part of North Kivu and in Ituri, there is not a visual impact of state of siege. In terms of winning land or capturing militia, because as you know, Islamist militia are very, very active in that part of country. So for them, for people of Beni region and Ituri, for them, state of siege has not meaning. In other sides, the army claimed to captured someone who is a Jordan citizen who were training ADF militias to pilot drones so that they can check and control the position of FARDC.
Now, is this the first time a fighter from outside the region has been captured?
This is the first time that a non-African fighter, because FARDC captured some Ugandans, Tanzanians, and Somalis people, but this is the first time an Arabic people, someone from the Middle East.
That was reporter Jafar Akatani in Goma speaking with my colleague Kate Pound-Dawson. The ADF, or Allied Democratic Forces, is the largest militia group fighting in Eastern DRC. Tunisian President Kais Saied took exceptional measures on Wednesday that strengthened the powers of his office at the expense of the government and parliament, declaring that he can rule by decree and ignore parts of the constitution. Amid growing opposition to the measures taken by the president 2 months ago to suspend parliament, lift MPs' immunity, and assume executive power, 5 political parties issued a joint statement urging the army and the judiciary to respect the constitution and uphold the rule of law. Mungi Dawoudi, a Tunisian-American political analyst, discussed the latest developments in Tunisia with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi.
This was something that we haven't seen since July 25th. These 5 different parties, most of them are left-leaning. One of them we could call a left to the center of Tunisia. They all got together and they've been meeting for quite some time, but finally they got to agree on a statement which they issued, especially after a interview given by one of Kais Saied's communication officials, who indicated on an interview with Sky News that the president is intending on writing a new constitution, going back to the drawing board through a committee that he will pick. And so all these parties, and there was a big pushback from civil society and political organizations, including these five who signed this statement. And I think the indication that Qais Saied is trying to make changes, if not change the whole constitution, made many political parties, some of them actually supported his July 25th move, but now they are backtracking and they are indicating that they are very, very concerned about the intentions of Qais Saied.
The signatories said that recent events have confirmed the fears they had expressed immediately after the president announced the state of emergency on July 25th, and they called on the military establishment to refrain from engaging in political conflicts and to abide by its role in defending the homeland. Would that mean there is an indication that the Tunisian army could be dragged into politics?
I think the person who dragged the Tunisian military into politics is the president himself. The day he called on them to shut down the parliament, and literally they placed a tank at the entrance of the parliament in Tunis. And I think this is the first time in Tunisian history where we see a military getting involved in a political crisis and siding with one side versus the other. And I think shutting down the parliament with a tank is really a very worrisome fact. And so I think these political parties, after they saw that the president is taking the country to the unknown, that he did not appoint a government, he did not offer a roadmap, indications that he's going to change the constitution, that he's adamant about not going back to the parliament, and I think made these political parties realize that this president is not listening to anyone, that he's not listening to people from the inside of the country. He's not listening to Tunisia's partners from outside. And therefore, I think they wanted to deliver a message to the military in the hope that they might listen. And they are appealing to the military history, to the Tunisian military culture that kept the military out of politics for so long. And I think they are banking maybe on that history and that culture that the military might pull back. If the military pulls back, then there is a big question whether Qais Saied could actually continue on this path after July 25th. But I think this message was crafted to appeal to the military, hoping that they will pull back and not support Qais Saied in his intentions.
Would the Tunisian army repeat the Egyptian experience?
I don't think so. Definitely, I hope not. I think at least there's no indication that they will do so. We heard some news that the military leadership is very uncomfortable at this stage, that the president hasn't appointed a government, that he hasn't said what he intends to do. And so he left the country in this situation. And I think the leadership of the military is very uncomfortable with this. And I don't think that they are willing or even able to carry out a total system of oppression and dragging the country into a dark tunnel. Let's remember that the military has never been part of the Ben Ali arsenal in terms of cracking down on any dissent. It's true that they used the military courts to go after some of his opponents, just much like we see now, but there is no indication that the military court is going to continue down this path. And definitely the military itself doesn't have in itself what it takes to do what the Egyptian military did, backing up Sisi in Egypt.
That was Mungi Dawoodi, a Tunisian-American political analyst, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohamed Elshenawy. Britain is gradually easing COVID-19 travel restrictions from Africa with its so-called red list of countries with the highest risk of spreading the virus. Arrivals from red list countries must have residence rights and are required to quarantine in a hotel for 10 days, even if they are vaccinated. South Africa remains on Britain's red list despite a decline in infections and having Africa's best medical system. The status is taking a toll on South African tourism and people wanting to visit their families in Britain, as Linda Giftash reports from Johannesburg.
Lynn Phillip hasn't seen her son and two grandchildren who live in England in 4 years. The 70-year-old Johannesburg resident had a flight booked to visit them last year when the pandemic struck, canceling all travel. Now, she's fully vaccinated with two Pfizer shots and desperate to go. but Philip says Britain's red list designation for South Africa is making it impossible.
I can't afford to go into quarantine there. Time-wise, it's going to be a problem. It cuts too much into your travel, into your visiting time. We do speak on Zoom, but that's not the same. And I just would like to be able to see my family.
Philip is not alone. Over 29,000 people have signed a change.org petition calling on British lawmakers to ease travel restrictions for South Africans, with many describing anguish over family separation. The UK embassy in South Africa reiterated the decision this week, saying it remains concerned about the presence of the Beta variant and its, quote, potential ability to circumvent vaccines. But Dr. Michelle Groom with South Africa's National Institute for Communicable Diseases says that rationale is at odds with the science.
That doesn't make any sense at all, because Delta is now making up, I think it's in excess of 96% of our sequences at the moment. So Beta is really not a concern at all. I don't see that there's any difference between us and say, Kenya or India or anyone else that has now been taken off the red list.
Africa Centers for Disease Control is also calling on the United Kingdom to review its position. The center says immunized Africans who are receiving the same vaccine as people in Europe should be recognized equally. While the United States has restricted entry for South Africans, the White House announced earlier this week that it will lift the rule for those who are fully vaccinated beginning in November. Several European countries have already made that shift. Ina Haust, a political scientist at the University of the Free State, says it's hard not to read Britain's restrictions as political.
There is reason to think that the region is being treated differently. When there are no clear answers based in fact, you know, speculations start to happen, and that can be dangerous and is certainly not good for diplomatic relations. The messaging is one then of prejudice, and it is now upon our diplomatic channels to ascertain why this is.
Dr. Groom says barring vaccinated travelers also sends the wrong message to the public about the effectiveness of vaccines.
We are trying very hard to promote vaccines in our country, and as with many countries are, you know, struggling a little bit with that traction that are hesitant to receive their vaccines. And in this case, you know, then it makes people question as to why, you know, perhaps that the vaccines that we're using are not as good as those being used elsewhere, which is obviously not correct.
The economic toll of the red list has also been crippling because the UK is the biggest source of tourists to South Africa. David Frost, chief executive of South Africa's Inbound Tourism Association, says the disappearance of British travellers is costing the country more than $1.7 million a day.
We've got a precious conservation base, which is one of the world's best, that is under total threat because there's no income, there's no money for anti-poaching activities. So 1 in 7 South Africans is putting food on their table because of tourism. And when tourism suffers, that means that people don't eat.
South Africa's International Relations Minister, Naledi Pandor, has echoed these concerns and is appealing to British officials to have the decision reversed. Frost says he hopes the added political push will pay off when the UK reviews its red list in coming weeks. Linda Giftash for VOA News, Johannesburg.
In South Africa, there are doubts about the credibility of the local government elections planned for the 1st of November. This, after the Constitutional Court upheld a decision by the country's Independent Electoral Commission, or IEC, that favored the ruling African National Congress, or ANC. The court is allowing the ANC to register candidates long after it missed a deadline to do so, which has infuriated opposition parties. Darren Taylor reports.
If the ANC hadn't been able to field candidates in certain wards, it obviously would have lost them to opposition politicians. The Constitutional Court said its ruling that allowed the IEC to reopen nominations for city and town councillor candidate lists was in the best interests of democracy. But Helen Ziller, federal chairperson of Chief Opposition the Democratic Alliance, or DA, says it's rather in the best interests of the ANC.
We'll know very well that the ANC didn't stand a chance before the Electoral Court because of the two previous precedents of ruling out the participation of parties that had missed previous deadlines, both in 2011 and in 2016.
So she says the ANC was forced to ask the Constitutional Court for an extension of 5 days to register candidates. This would allow the IEC to reopen the candidate nomination system.
And that's exactly what has happened. Word for word, step by step, process by process. And no one has yet answer the question, least of all the journalists, as to why the ANC suddenly withdrew its case a couple of hours after putting it before the Electoral Court.
Zilla suspects that someone within the Constitutional Court leaked information to the ruling party that it was going to allow an extension. This, she says, would be further evidence of institutional favoritism toward the ANC. University of Free State politics professor Setulego Matabisi says while the court's decision sets a potentially dangerous precedent, it's the correct one.
I would have had a huge concern if the list was only open and another opportunity was afforded only to the African National Congress. All political parties in South Africa has an opportunity to resubmit names if they want to. And I don't think this will necessarily benefit the African National Congress. The playing field is still being leveled. And for one...
But polls show that decades of failure, mismanagement and corruption at government institutions mean that public trust in them is at an all-time low. Matabisi agrees this may prevent many voters from casting ballots in a few weeks' time.
One credible institution that we have up until this far in terms of consolidating our democracy has been the IEC. I think it will be a huge, huge, huge problem if we are also going to have issues around the credibility of the IEC. But that does not mean...
IEC spokesman Granville Abrahams says it's committed to ensuring a free and fair election, despite the daunting challenge.
We would need to print about 5,000 ballot papers that look different. For national and provincial election, we only print 10 ballot papers, and they only need to go to 9 places, your 9 different provinces. But the close to 5,000 ballot papers will have to go to 23,000 voting stations, so it's important that we get it right.
The ANC says it's overjoyed at being able to field all its officials seeking positions as city and town councillors and mayors. Political analysts say the ANC needs all the help it can get going into these municipal elections. The party is riven by infighting. It has rival candidates within its ranks killing one another, and citizens are protesting across South Africa about the poor services rendered by ANC councillors. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
The head of Libya's presidential council, Mohamed Al-Menfi, used his address to the UN General Assembly to call for international action to facilitate the withdrawal of foreign troops and mercenaries from Libya as the country prepares for elections on December 24th. He asked the international community to secure fair elections to avoid going back to military conflict and division. Ahmed Fati, a global affairs analyst and a UN correspondent, discussed the highlights of the Libyan address with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi.
The mercenaries are a major problem in Libya's situation since the fall of the Gaddafi regime and the escalation and later the division of the country between the eastern part and the western part. Right now, there are mainly two groups. One were an overflow from those who were in Iraq and Syria, and those they came through the Mediterranean, and another are contracted mercenaries through corporate entities in Europe. When we have the other countries are backing those major groups, can exercise some pressure on them, maybe there would be a breakthrough. Right now, the situation in the West, you have a government internationally endorsed and recognized with a presidential council, and you have in the East a de facto ruler or region with most of the Libya's resources and a military force, a self-styled Libyan army. However, who can exercise the influence? There have to be backroom trades between various powers. There is a lot at risk with the mercenary issue. And I think if this would be resolved, I think Libya can successfully move into the second phase with the elections at the end of the year.
Al-Menfi also stressed the importance of holding free elections that could lead to stability and democracy. How would it take place when the Eastern House of Representatives approved a constitutional basis for the elections that allows military officers to run for presidency? while the Presidential Council is offering another list of constitutional bases?
As of today, the head of the Libyan National Army, General Haftar, has stepped down temporarily for a period of 3 months. This is a kind of a legal maneuver he took in order to make him qualified to get to the presidential election. In the meantime, he appointed his chief of staff with a mandate till the end of the election cycle. There is also another player, another force that less talked about, the son of the late leader of Libya, Muammar Gaddafi, Saif al-Islam al-Gaddafi. He's also a potential candidate. I think it's going to be interesting to see how this is going to play out. Without compromises, there's not going to be a national unity. That's what Libyans and Libya needs the most.
Al-Menfi told the United Nations General Assembly that Libya will host an international meeting next month attended by regional and international partners to support Libya's stability. Could such a meeting achieve what Berlin 1 and Berlin 2 conferences failed to achieve?
Yesterday, there was a meeting in New York shared by Germany, France, Italy, countries that they were participating in the neighboring group who were part in the Berlin process. They are also concerned about it. However, they have endorsed El Manfi Presidential Council. The French have interests, so as the Italians, so as the Russians. Lots of the arms that was equipped for the defunct Libyan army were Russian hardware. So Russia have also an interest. Turkey, on the other side, trying to redraw the maritime borders in the Mediterranean. And they need a regime in Libya that is friendly to them, that they found in the government in the western part. The Italians are walking the fine and tight rope. Haftar supporters predominantly Egypt, United Arab Emirates, and Saudi Arabia. There is a lot of acts of proxy wars, but there is also acts of contradicting and conflicting interests. The disintegration of Libya is not in the favor of anybody. The territorial integrity is very important for the region, for its neighbors, and for the peace and security in this important part, not only for Africa, but also for Europe.
That was Ahmed Fati, a global affairs analyst and a UN correspondent, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohamed Elshenawy. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I am Junior Rocco in Washington. For all latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. And thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's newsmaker interview program. Join us each Saturday and Sunday when we talk with authors, analysts, and policymakers who provide fresh insight on topics ranging from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. You can listen to Press Conference USA on the radio or online at voanews.com/PCUSA. While you're visiting our website, be sure to subscribe to our podcast. We'd also love to hear from you. Just send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or connect with us on Facebook at facebook.com/CarolCastielVOA or on Twitter at CarolCastielVOA. That's Press Conference USA every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
The Voice of America's Global News Program, International Edition, brings you an in-depth look at the biggest news stories of the day. Nobody covers the world more comprehensively than VOA. Our correspondents gather the news and the views of the most seasoned experts on international issues. Tune in Monday through Friday at 3:30 and 17:05 UTC on The Voice of America.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bonga flavor to sikus, afrobeat to ndombolo and makosa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05.